where to draw the line between physician guidance and respecting surrogate and patient wishes. Do surrogate decision makers need more help from doctors on end-of-life care? A couple of medical journal articles address that issue, and joining us now to talk about it is John Carney. He is the Vice President for Aging and End-of-Life at the Center for Practical Bioethics. John, anything new in these articles about the tough job of a surrogate decision maker?
Well, it certainly reinforces the fact that it is definitely a tough job. Really what it says is that, in general, people want to be able to make the decisions along with their family members and obviously the patient when the time comes to be able to say life-sustaining treatment is going to be beneficial or it's not going to be beneficial. They want to be involved in that process and in many cases want to be the last person to speak. What it does say is that there is a minority of people, a very small group of people, who don't want to have anything to do with it. But what I think it really underscores is this idea that we're moving towards is that it's a shared decision and that it really is based on lots of conversations and really focuses on values, the values and preferences. How do we elicit those values and preferences so when those specific clinical questions come up, we know where mom or dad would land on that issue and that we need to follow those wishes?
Well, Dr. Daniel Solmazy wrote about this in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and one thing he talked about was the fact that with advanced directives and the lack of them, only 5 to 25% of patients have such documents. But a real problem is that they fail to cover the precise clinical situation at hand, and that's a problem, isn't it?
It is a problem, and it's one that has been growing over the last 20 years since we've really had healthcare directives that specifically, you know, the checkbox approach. We've really abandoned that effort, and mainly because it isn't helpful. In the early days when we first did it, there weren't a whole lot of things that we could do to prolong the life of a patient. There are now a myriad, you know, opportunities for us to be able to say, well, we could try this, and we could try this, and we could try this. And sometimes those aren't necessarily reflective of what the patient would want. So we're moving away from that healthcare directive to the appointment of the agent, which is really the flip side of the form, and saying what you really need to do is have substantive, value-laden conversations about those wishes. And then when the time comes for that clinical checkbox to be made, you know, for the doctor to come in and say, okay, so what are we doing here? You've got some background. You've got some history. You've got some knowledge about what mom would want. And then you're able to help the doctor say, yes, this is going to reflect her values and preferences, and this is the clinical decision that we're going to go towards.
Still, though, Dr. Solmazy notes, and I'm quoting from his article, you get questions like, would the patient have wanted a dopamine infusion at 2 micrograms per minute if they were in a coma and in addition had Alzheimer's disease and pneumonia and were in the ICU? That's not something that I would think too many of us have discussions about.
No, and that's why the discussion needs to be about how important is it for mom when she knows she's losing capacity, and usually you do early on. Cognitive impairment is pretty apparent early on. What is it that she values in terms of being able to recognize and participate with her family? What kind of values does she have around that, being able to recognize family members, participate in discussions? And a lot of it has to do, obviously, with other comorbid conditions, other disease processes that are going on with the patient. And knowing from that conversation what we need to be able to answer when the doctor says, okay, here is a specific treatment. It really is burdensome for families, for doctors to project even those kinds of questions. Most of us, even people who have nursing backgrounds and some physicians wouldn't know the answer to that question in and of itself. So assuming that somebody's going to be able to say yay or nay on something like that is, I think, just overreaching. We need to be able to say, what does your mother think about the importance of her being able to make decisions around the extension of her life when she can no longer communicate and no longer? And for some people, that's a religious, you know, it's a deeply religious held conviction. And it's very important and very clear. For others, it's like mom wouldn't want this. She wouldn't want us to prolong her suffering. She wouldn't. So those are the kind of things that a doctor needs to be able to elicit, not the specific treatment. It isn't helpful to families to ask that or to even have a checkbox in that kind of thing, which is one of the reasons we've gotten away from checkboxes and said, tell me what your preferences and values are. Don't tell me what specific treatments you would or wouldn't want unless you already know and can very clearly state these kinds of things. But in many, many cases, there's things we can do to help somebody get over a hurdle, get through a particular episode and return at least in some form or function to a life that they've understood and valued. And that's fine.
So then the key question is, what does this mean and where will this go? What kind of end result are we looking for, at least at this stage?
It's about goals of care. It's, okay, if we do this, what will that achieve? What is this intervention supposed to be able to get for us? And then that is then that answer is put aside next to the question about what does mom value and what does she want? What's her goals of care? What are her, you know, quality standards that she's expecting? And be able to say, this would help us get to that. This would help us get to this other thing. Now we need to decide which path we need to follow. And that's the struggle for the surrogate, is you're always going to wonder if it's the other path you should have taken. And that's, we can never relieve that burden. But if we can say, this obviously was born of good knowledge, good facts, good understanding of what mom would want, you can at least say, let's try this and see where it goes, because this is what we know mom would want. This is what she values and this is what she would want.
Now, Dr. Salmazi addresses the substituted interest model. What would that engage or what would that involve and how would that move the process forward?
Well, I'm not sure whether he's talking about substituted judgment or best interest, and it may be a combination of the two. Basically, a substituted judgment simply says that I have an instruction from you, and I know what I'm supposed to do, and it's my responsibility to do it. Best interest says, I don't know what you would want in this case, but I'm going to assume that this would be in your best interest, and so I'm going to do it. Substituted interest, I would assume, means I think I have a pretty good notion of what it is that they would want. She's not given me a particular instruction, but this is what I'm guessing from what I know of her, not necessarily guessing, but this is what I would be led to believe. And in terms of this treatment, so we're going to try it. We're going to go for this, and this is what we're hoping to be able to achieve, as long as that goal of care is clear in that process. One other point I wanted to make, too, early on is the 5 to 25% figure is basically across all ages.
And that's
across,
for advanced directives.
Advanced directives, and across all Americans. For the people that we're talking about in most of these cases, about 50 to 75% of them, people who actually have conditions that would lead them to very quickly to these kinds of situations where somebody needs to make a decision or has cognitive impairment, the relative numbers that we see of those folks who already have advanced directives is in the 50 to 75% range. So it's still, you know, there's still half the folks out there that we need to help with this process, but it's not nearly as bad as I think the article may have pointed out, that all Americans, most young people do not have these. They should, but they don't.
But that would still imply that people don't make an advance directive or designate a durable power of attorney until there is an onset of a medical condition that may lead to a serious illness or the end of life.
That's true. And I think that's the American aversion to death, this notion that we see death as optional, and our reluctance to really embrace the aging process and the dying process as an extension of our current lives. You know, we see this kind of as a thing to be avoided, and we really need to begin to integrate that in. And I think the aging of society is going to help us do that. We're going to have more substantive conversations. When you meet people in these situations, most of them are struggling with it and know that they need to be talking about it. Facilitating the conversation, allowing them to be able to kind of draw out values and preferences, which is a tough process. It's a skill that very few people in the healthcare profession have. That's what needs to be done.
Not to mention the lay population.
Oh, I don't think lay population ever even assumes they should have that. I mean, I think they see it as a medical decision, and it's not. You're right, it's not. It should be around, you know, our beliefs and our value systems. But what comes to bear is a decision that has to be made medically. So it becomes a medical discussion, though it shouldn't be.
Another article appears to take a little bit of an opposite tack in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. It seems they imply that more people really want that decision to be made by themselves and not so much the doctor.
Yeah, I think the doctor's role is really to present the projected clinical outcomes in a particular way if this particular intervention is chosen, and then to back off and to allow the family to be able to take that information and then discuss goals of care and what is it we're trying to do, and the doctor to help facilitate to say, all right, if you're going to tell me this is the goal, then I would lean towards this intervention. And if this is the other goal, then I would lean towards this intervention. And to stay out of saying even things like, well, what would you do if this were your mother? I don't think that's the role of the medical professional. The role of the medical professional is to say, what is important to your mother? And let's see if we can match up what it is that she's saying her goal is with a particular treatment. That's a conversation that families are going to have to insist on from their perspective when they walk into the doctor, not just the doctor saying, this is what I'm recommending because this is the next step in our normal standard of care. It's like, wait a minute. We don't have to go there if mom has said she wants something else, or we don't have to stop if mom says she wants to continue. And those are the kind of conversations that many of us are not prepared for.
That sounds time-consuming, though, John.
It is time-consuming. And this is not – I mean, doctors don't get paid for it right now. Mm-hmm. It really is going to have to be, you know, patients and families insisting. I think that we're going to have to change some rules to be able to allow medical professionals to do this. It may come more about from physician extenders through advanced practice nurses or other members of the team, the medical team, who have that conversation. And then the decision is rendered and taken back to the doc, and the doc knows what to do. I'm not exactly sure how we'll get all this worked out, but – Americans are wakening up to the fact that we're not going to live forever. Many things that we do to people in the final stages of illness are not helpful to them. We now know that. And as a result of that, we're beginning to question simply medical treatment for medical treatment's sake is not necessarily the answer.
John Carney is the Vice President for Aging and End of Life at the Center for Practical Bioethics. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.